It's tape number 7, Westmoreland.
Lane, roll 7, shot 1, take 1, General Westmoreland.
Stand by.
No single battlefield event in Vietnam elicited more public disparagement of my conduct of the Vietnam War than did my decision in early 1968 to stand and fight at Khe Sanh. The decision to hold on to that previously obscure little plateau in the rugged northwestern corner of South Vietnam was, to my mind, militarily sound and strategically rewarding. Yet many who viewed it from a distance deemed it misguided and tragic.
General, the first question we want to ask is, why was Khe Sanh held?
There were a number of reasons. First, it outflanked the defense line south of the demilitarized zone. And if the enemy had held Khe Sanh, he could have rolled up the defense positions to the east of Khe Sanh and south of the 18th parallel. In addition to that, the enemy wanted to get into the populated areas and mixed among the people, which would have made it very difficult to be rooted out and would have been very costly, since civilian property would have inevitably been destroyed. And in addition, civilians would have been jeopardized by the fighting that would have ensued along the coastal populated area. I hoped that the enemy would stand and fight at Khe Sanh, and he accommodated me, because in Khe Sanh it was relatively unpopulated. There were some mountain people there which were moved out. As a matter of fact, they came in as refugees. We took care of them and evacuated them to safety. And thereafter, there was no population around there, and therefore I could use the firepower available to me without jeopardizing civilian property or civilians. Fortunately, the enemy decided to try to seize Khe Sanh, and those 2.5 divisions involved were virtually destroyed there. If we had abandoned Khe Sanh, those 2.5 divisions would have moved into the populated areas and would have taken us months and perhaps over a year to root them out at great cost to civilian property and would have jeopardized civilian lives.
General, follow-up question. Many of the media critics talked about parallels between Dien Bien Phu and Khe Sanh. What they didn't realize is that you had studied the Battle of Dien Bien Phu very carefully. Could you talk a little bit about your research into Dien Bien Phu?
Well, I was quite familiar with the Battle of Dien Bien Phu. But in addition to that, I had my command historian do a detailed research on the Battle of Dien Bien Phu and brief me and my staff. There were some common features, but there were more differences than there were common elements between the two engagements. The primary difference was that Dien Bien Phu was very far inland. Khe Sanh was, less than 20 miles from outposts that we had south of the demilitarized zone. Khe Sanh was within the range fan of our long-range artillery. In addition to that, we had massive air power. In addition, we had the capability of landing supplies there, and if the airfield was closed, and eventually was by the enemy artillery, we had the capability, since this had been anticipated, not necessarily at Khe Sanh, but anticipated it would occur somewhere in Vietnam, where we could supply those troops by cargo parachutes.
Now, about the defense itself, how effective were the B-52 strikes that you employed?
Extremely effective. The Marines were told to defend and they did so admirably. I did not want them making raids or forays outside of the defended area, because that would have masked our artillery and our airstrikes. And I did not want anything to interfere with that. I didn't want to have to call off a strike. It could have been very effective because there were enemy patrols in the area. We had ability to drop bombs quite accurately using radar sights and offset methods, regardless of weather, day and night. But in addition to that, we had a new development on the battlefield. We had electronic sensors. They had been installed along the so-called Ho Chi Minh Trail in Laos, and I had them shifted to the environs of Khe Sanh, so that we were able to pick up evidence of movement of enemy troops, and we could react either with tactical bombers or B-52s or artillery shelling against this intelligence.
Why did you delay the offensive movement out from Khe Sanh? Or when did it finally come?
Well, first place, the Marines were under no jeopardy after the enemy had been crippled, and in final analysis, those two-plus divisions, or I would say roughly two-and-a-half divisions, were certainly rendered ineffective, but effective, were virtually destroyed. The percentage of the enemy tied up there was far, far greater than the number of people we had in the defending area by ratio of I would say, 3 to 4 to 1. We planned that operation known as Operation Pegasus very, very carefully. I wanted to make the link up and open up Highway 9 with the minimum of casualties and the minimum expenditure of resources. We had our plans worked out in great detail, but one of the imponderables was the weather. I had weather patterns studied for 20 years back, and the conclusion was that the risks with respect to the weather that could have interfered with our tactical airstrikes, which require a visual observation, and would have interfered with the movement of our troops by helicopter. And you have to remember, this was mountainous country. April 1st was the breaking point. And after April 1st, the risks were acceptable. So I held off until I felt that the chances were 90% that this would be a successful operation with minimum loss. And fortunately, that judgment was correct.
One final question about the defense. Did the Marine style make any difference in the way the defense was conducted?
Marines, and properly so, are trained to go on the offensive. And they have made a fine military reputation because of their ability in the attack. The Marines don't like to defend. In fact, no troops do. All troops would rather be on the offensive. But by virtue of this state of mind, I did have difficulty getting the Marines to dig in. I finally succeeded, but it took an awful lot of effort, not only by myself, but by primarily their own commanders, to get to dig in to protect themselves, to reduce casualties, because the enemy did have a great quantity of rockets and conventional artillery, which they used, well, round the clock.
A follow-up, which you may or may not want to respond to. How was your working relationship with Colonel Lowndes, the commanding officer at Khe Sanh?
Well, of course, he did not report to me. He reported to General Thompson, who commanded the 3rd Marine Division. While Khe Sanh was under siege, I flew up and visited with Lowndes. And I thought he was a very competent combat soldier, and I think he conducted himself admirably during this very difficult period.
Okay, the next question, we're getting away from Khe Sanh and more to Tet in general. A troop request was submitted for 206,000 men, and this was viewed in the United States and in the newspapers as a sign that the NVA were victorious in Tet. What is the controversy about the request for 206,000 men?
Well, this was a distortion of major magnitude. The press jumped to the conclusion, which was erroneous, and gave the American people a false impression. This came out of a conference between General Wheeler and myself. General Wheeler was the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and he came to Vietnam. I was urging for a change in strategy. I knew that the Tet Offensive was going to be defeated, and I knew from my study of military history that if we had followed up the defeat of the enemy, we could have brought the enemy to the conference table. There was some consideration at that time. Certainly the chairman of the House Armed Services Committee, Mr. Rivers, was on public record that he wanted to call up the reserves. There were members of the administration that were inclined to do this, and the Joint Chiefs of Staff likewise. On the assumption that the reserves would be called up, I was asked to put in a troop list of what I wanted that could bring